Thanks, and thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be back here. So let me start my talk right away with sort of a big picture motivation or sort of a big picture embedding of the things I will talk about, and that's the current status of quantum gravity. So we have a number of different theoretical approaches in this quantum gravity landscape. And there's a scientific perspective on that. I would say that each of these approaches here is facing one or another challenge, some of them technical, others more conceptual. Most approaches, I would say, face both types of challenges. And there's also a sociological perspective to the current status of quantum gravity in that these little islands really form sub-communities on their own, and that there isn't necessarily too much crosstalk between these different approaches, so that methods and ideas are only sometimes exported or imported between the approaches. Now, why am I saying that? Because I will be advocating the view that one way to address challenges in the various approaches, not the only one, of course, but one could be to connect quantum gravity approaches to each other and to use tools or techniques that have been developed in one approach, use them to address a problem in another approach. And not only that, but also borrow inspiration for which type of questions to ask. So if asking a particular question has led to some interesting insights in one approach to quantum gravity, then maybe asking the same type of question in another approach could be worthwhile. And I think to some extent, to do that more, that requires a bit of a change in this sociology of quantum gravity that I was referring to. So more crosstalk between the approaches. And of course, given that Bianca is here, I'll have to advertise the International Society of Quantum Gravity, which is trying to do exactly that, generate more crosstalks between approaches. And of course, Bianca is very, very, very actively pushing that initiative. And now, to make this sort of more general idea more concrete, what I will do in this talk here, I will focus on two approaches, causal set quantum gravity and asymptotically safe quantum gravity, that really on the outset don't have much to do with each other. And I'll give you two examples that indeed sort of borrowing ideas or methods from one and transferring them to the other, that could actually be useful to tackle some of the challenges in each of these approaches. And I'm assuming that you have heard about both of these approaches before, so I'll just give sort of lightning reviews of those to remind you of the most important features of those approaches. So I'll start with those lightning reviews, and then I'll go into the specific works making the connections between the two. So here's my lightning introduction to causal set quantum gravity. Its key assumptions that it's based on is Lorentzian signature. So it is one of the few approaches that really takes the space-time nature of gravity very, very seriously. It also takes Lorentz invariance very seriously. And as the second assumption, it has discreteness. And if you combine that with Lorentzian signature and with Lorentz invariance, then the discreteness cannot be a type of spatial discreteness, but it has to be spatial-temporal discreteness. And so that basically leads you to say that the way to think about spacetime in causal sets is that spacetime becomes a network of spacetime points. So those are the points in this graph here. Those are the spacetime points. And it's a network, so these points are connected by links. And these links are causal links. So two points can be connected only if they are causally connected. And so what you're looking at here is sort of a chunk of a Minkowski, one plus one dimensional Minkowski spacetime, and one of the causal sets that corresponds to that. So how do you then build a quantum theory out of that? So that's based on the path integral, or more precisely, because this is discrete, on the path sum over all causal sets weighted with a quantum mechanical phase factor. So here again, you're taking the Lorentzian signature very seriously, and so you're not doing any sort of statistical physics generating functional with an exponential suppression, but really with a quantum mechanical phase factor. And the configuration space in here is the space of all causal sets. And causal sets are generally defined as follows. They are sets of space-time points with very little structure. The only structure they have is a relation. That relation is called precedes, and it means precede in a causal sense. So if x precedes y, then that means that x is really the causal past of y. And so in order for that to be a reasonable causal relation, it has to satisfy two properties, namely, if x precedes y and if y precedes z, then x also precedes z. That is pretty obvious if you think of sort of causal order in spacetime. Then you also want to exclude closed time-like curves. And so if x precedes y and y precedes x, then it means that x has to be equal to y. And that is possible because this relation is defined in such a way that the spacetime point is defined to also precede itself. So far, these two properties are things that causal order in any continuum manifold without closed time-like curves satisfies. And so the third is what really makes causal sets discrete, because it says that if you take any two points, let's say this one up here, and then this one down here, and then if you look at the points that are causally in between, in this case, these are the 1, 2, 3, 4 here, that has to be a finite number. So the cardinality of the set of points that lie in between x and y, that cardinality has to be finite. And this is what distinguishes a causal set from a continuum manifold, because in a continuum manifold, when you take two points, one of them in the causal past of the other, no matter how close they are to each other, there will always be an infinite number of points in between.
I like that the last conditions are, of course, very clear. But the defining equation z equal to something is completely formal, because I don't know what the major is, and I don't know what even the action is, which normally we do know what the action is.
So there is a proposal for a causal set action here, which is basically a discrete version of the curvature scalar. But I'll come back to this question of what sort of terms should we write into the action in the second part of the talk. And I agree that this expression is at least as formal as any expression of that type in a quantum field theory. And in fact, it's a big question whether if you take the full configuration space, whether you can actually get an action that kills off all of the contributions which are non-manifold like causal sets. Because if you look at the set of causal sets, then those causal sets which are non-manifold like, they absolutely dominate that set. So manifold like causal sets are a set of measure zero. So we really want this action here to be very specific so that it filters out a very, very particular set of causal sets. All right, so that's my lightning introduction to causal sets. So let's now do the lightning introduction to asymptotic safety. So the key assumptions here are that the metric continues to carry the gravitational degrees of freedom as it does in GR. Maybe as a side note, you could in principle think of using other degrees of freedom, like for instance Fehlbein and connection. That is done to some extent, but usually one really bases this theory on the metric. And then one takes a standard, or more or less standard, quantum field theory approach, and in particular a path integral. And then the thing to demand is that has a finite number of free parameters so that it's predictive. So that's a condition that in many other quantum gravity approaches we don't think of so much, this question of how many free parameters are there. In asymptotic safety, this predictivity, or that the theory is defined with a finite number of free parameters, that is really one of the key ingredients. And these two actually lead to demand quantum scale symmetry. And I'll show you now how you get from these requirements to quantum scale symmetry. So if you want to write down a standard quantum field theory in the path integral formalism over metrics with some action where you could reasonably start with the Einstein-Hilbert action, then of course the problem is if you do that perturbatively, it's non-renormalizable. So at successive loop orders, you get higher order counterterms. Each one of them comes with a free parameter. And so if you go to a successively higher loop order, whatever prediction you've made at the loop order before, you can always circumvent by just using the free parameter at the n plus 1th loop order. And so predictivity breaks down. And the solution to that is to demand that there's quantum scale symmetry. Heuristically, that's a solution because whenever you demand more symmetry of your Lagrangian, then that constrains couplings or relates them to each other. And in particular, that is true of quantum scale symmetry. So that gives us an infinite number of relations between the couplings such that you get predictivity back. And just a few more words about quantum scale symmetry. Yeah?
Why do you call it quantum?
I will get to that with this plot here. So you demand some form of scale symmetry first. And of course, once you have quantum fluctuations present, then generically you don't have scale symmetry anymore. The theory depends on the scale. So your couplings in the theory are driven by quantum fluctuations, and they have a non-trivial renormalization group flow. You can get scale symmetry back at fixed points of the renormalization group. And there is a sort of trivial way to do that, namely by having your couplings go to zero so that you get asymptotic freedom. In this way, you effectively, because you switch off interactions, you turn off the effect of quantum fluctuations, and you sort of get back classical scale symmetry in some sense. You can't get that for Einstein gravity. That's just a rephrasing of the statement of perturbative renormalizability. And then asymptotic safety demands that the couplings become constant at finite values. And that means that interactions are still present and quantum fluctuations don't decouple. And so this is really a form of scale symmetry that uses quantum fluctuations. So the quantum fluctuations need to be there such that quantum fluctuations of different fields or interactions can balance out appropriately to give you scale symmetry. And therefore, I'm calling it quantum scale symmetry because it really relies on quantum fluctuations. And so then sort of the cartoon of asymptotic safety for gravity is that if you take the Newton coupling, multiply it by the energy scale squared to get a dimensionless measure of the strength of gravity, that increases from tiny values to values of order 1 at the Planck scale, where quantum fluctuations of gravity then really kick in, and they can balance this growth and give you asymptotic safety. And the same type of picture then holds for higher order couplings. And there's lots of work confirming that this type of cartoon is actually something that could really be realized for quantum gravity. All right, so that concludes my lightning introduction to asymptotic safety.
So the assumption, I mean, we have to understand what k-squared means, because in a curved space-time, I don't know what k-squared means. So it's some perturbative thing that is really used, some background or something.
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, you can think of k as just some external parameter that you put into the path integral that gives you some way of sorting your configurations so that you don't integrate them all at once, but you do that step by step. But then you want k to have a more physical meaning. And so you can associate it with basically the eigenvalues of some appropriate D'Alembertian, and in order for that to work, you indeed need to put in a background metric.
But also Euclidean.
Yes, it's also Euclidean, and I'll be coming back to that as one of my main challenges that I hope to address with causal sets.
Yeah, ask this question because I don't know the recent progress also.
So let me just mention that there are more recent papers that have started to look at asymptotic safety in a Lorentzian regime. There's one first paper on that which is in a simple approximation and sees asymptotic safety, but there isn't really, I mean, there is no comparable body of work to what has been done in the Euclidean. So I would say that Lorentzian signature very much remains an open challenge, and I'll be coming back to that open challenge, in fact. Right.
I have a question online.
Yeah.
On the previous slide, you say, if you go back one slide, here you say in the second line, theory is scale dependent. Presumably, you mean the theory depends on k?
Yes.
I don't really understand this statement because you said k is an external parameter introduced.
In a quantum field theory, you can think of that scale as being, for instance, the momentum scale in scattering experiments, right? So in the presence of quantum fluctuations, generically couplings start to depend on basically whatever scale you have in the theory that you vary. That could be, for instance, the momentum scale in scattering experiments. But it can also be a more abstract
discussion. You said that there is a difficulty about backgrounds. If you want to introduce K and with an interpretation of scattering, you have to introduce a background. Now, suppose I want to consider the path integral defined background independently. Then you say K is an external parameter introduced temporarily. And then if I use a finite K version, fixed K, that's not the full theory. I'm not integrating over everything there is in the original path integral. In that case, only if I take K to be a specific value do I recover the original path integral. I don't understand why the theory itself is scale dependent.
Yeah. So if you want to be precise, then maybe the appropriate word to use instead of theory here is to say that the dynamics is scale dependent. And in fact, the dynamics depends both on this RG scale, which is a more mathematical parameter, but also if you manage to do the full path integral, it will have a dependence on physical scales. So for instance, the resulting dynamics will change as you change the curvature scale that you look at.
Not sure I understand either, because in the full path integral, you fix an action. An action is there. It doesn't move, it doesn't change.
Yeah, but
why is dynamics scale dependent?
Yeah, but I mean, fixing the classical action in the path integral, that's one thing. But what you actually want to look at in order to really connect with observations is an effective dynamics. And that effective dynamics, you can write the full effective action, but then the thing that you typically need is whatever is sort of most suitable to the typical scale of the setting that you look at. But
sure,
I feel that we're also getting sidetracked a little bit from what I would actually like to come to in this talk. So maybe we can come back to this discussion in the question session, because this is really not one of the main challenges that I was going to address in this talk. I was going to address different challenges of causal sets and asymptotic safety. So if that's okay, I would like to defer the rest of the discussion to the end. So what I will do now first is to look at a particular challenge in causal set quantum gravity and how I think we could use results or ideas from asymptotic safety to address that. And that challenge is observational tests. So how do we actually test the ideas underlying causal sets? There are some ideas out there. One idea is particle swerves, which is basically the idea that if spacetime is discrete, particles can't follow continuous geodesics. So instead, they have to sort of follow a more or less wiggly path. And if you describe that in momentum space, that would lead to a diffusion in momentum space, which means that a particle that is propagates for long enough has a certain probability to gain momentum or to sort of heat up in this process. That's one proposal. Another is related to the cosmological constant, explaining it as a sort of fluctuating field and relating its typical size to the size of the universe. I'm not going to detail here details here. If you're interested in that, there's a very nice talk that Yasaman Yazdi gave in the quantum space-time workshop just 2 weeks ago that I think you can find online. So instead, I would like to make a sort of third proposal for how you could connect causal sets to observations, and that's what I would call a meta-metas program. What the meta-metas program is all about is to say that properties of elementary particles that are either already observed or observable, such as their masses and their interaction strength, they effectively constrain the underlying quantum gravity theory. And within asymptotic safety, that program has a number of examples to show that that could in fact work. For instance, the Higgs mass can be constrained from asymptotic safety, as well as a bunch of other couplings. So I'll not go into the details of how the asymptotic safety idea works. I just take that as inspiration to say, could we do something similar in causal sets? And we are immediately encountering a challenge, which is that causal sets is such a bare bones approach that it throws out basically all of the concepts related to a manifold, and therefore you don't even have such simple things as a tangent space, and so you don't know how to define local Lorentz transformations, and accordingly you don't know how to define fermions and vectors. Basically anything that carries a spacetime index is a huge challenge to define in a causal set. Now, fortunately, we have indications for a scalar in nature, and that is the Higgs. What I recently set out to do together with one of my postdocs, Gustavo De Brito, and a master's student, Ludivine Fausten, whose master thesis this was, we set out to see whether we can derive a bound on the Higgs mass from causal set quantum gravity. And what we are using is that people before us have thought about how the propagator for a scalar field could look like on a causal set. It starts out from defining this operator B that is basically the discrete version of a derivative operator. And so it takes the scalar field at this point up here, and then it subtracts the value of that scalar field at all of its nearest neighbors. And it's the nearest neighbors in a causal sense, so it means that it's all those points that share a link with the point up here. And then you're adding the value of the scalar field at the next two nearest neighbors. So those are these blue points. The next two nearest neighbors in a causal sense are those points which have exactly one point in between them. And then you go to the next two nearest neighbors, and so on. So you're basically doing something similar to what you would do if you would discretize a standard derivative operator on a lattice, right? If you think of a derivative operator on a discrete lattice, you would take the field at a point, subtract the nearest neighbors, add the next two nearest neighbors, and so on. So you're basically doing the exact same type of thing here, just in a causal sense.
So numerical factors, 9, 16?
So those factors are fixed, because if you go through a lengthy proof, you can show that if you take the expectation value of this operator over different sprinklings into a manifold, so basically different causal sets that correspond to the same continuum manifold, and then you take the limit of this discreteness scale to zero, then this operator gives you exactly box minus 1/2 R acting on a scalar field. But I don't think there's any sort of nice intuitive a priori way of seeing that it's 9 or 16, at least not one that I'm aware of. These numbers also, I think, depend on the space-time dimensionality that you're interested in. Yeah. All right, so this gives us an operator that basically gives us a D'Alembertian, and so the inverse of that would be the propagator of the scalar field. Now, there's one slight complication, namely that people have actually looked at not just the expectation value here, but also at the size of fluctuations about that expectation value. And they have found that fluctuations about this average actually grow as you decrease the discreteness scale. And if you want the discreteness scale to be of the order of the Planck scale, then fluctuations about this average would actually be pretty big. And so on any particular realization of a causal set that corresponds to a manifold, this expression would deviate from this continuum result by a lot. And so what people then in causal sets did is they said, well, so we replace the discreteness scale in here by a non-locality scale, and we keep that scale fixed, and we keep it much, much larger as a length scale than the Planck scale. And then this non-locality scale controls the size of fluctuations, and if you choose it large enough, so really many orders of magnitude larger than the Planck scale, then you can get fluctuations which are small enough, and where you say that this is then a sort of acceptable definition of a D'Alembertian with controlled size of fluctuations.
Why factor 1/2 R? What's secret about 1/2 R?
So that's just what comes out of here.
Yeah, but that's...
And so in the first part of my talk, I will actually be looking at that on Minkowski spacetime, right, where this will go away. In the second part, I will actually be focusing on the R part. Okay. So I will be using both halves in this talk here. First of all, if we focus on Minkowski spacetime, then this really just gives us the D'Alembertian. And I think maybe one answer to your question would be that it's not known how to construct something that doesn't have this 1/2 R. So the corresponding expression to write down here isn't known. So the only thing that you can get is this combination.
It's really driven by one's lack of ability, not because of fundamental consideration.
No. It's really sort of the best thing that can be achieved is to write this. And then that's already... writing here, that this can be shown, if you look at the papers that show it's really a tough calculation. So in any case, I'll then focus on the Minkowski spacetime version for now, where the propagator is just basically the inverse of that, written in a rather sloppy form. And that provides a lengthy expression that I will not write out here because I don't think it's very, very illuminating. The thing to know about it is that this propagator reduces to a standard quantum field propagator for a scalar field 1 over pi, p squared in the infrared, where the infrared means distances which are much larger than this non-locality scale, because there all of the effects of the causal set go away and you're just recovering standard quantum field theory. But then in the UV, where by in the UV I mean distances which are larger than the non-locality scale, but still distances which are smaller than the non-locality scale, but larger than the discreteness scale. So that's the UV in which you have still a quantum field theory description, but a modified one. The propagator scales like constant minus 1 over p to the 4. So if you want to think about the scales in the setting, we have a discreteness scale, and at smaller distances, the continuum description breaks down, so no more continuum quantum field theory. Then there's a regime between the discreteness scale and this non-locality scale, where the propagator is modified and behaves like this. And then at scales larger than the non-locality scale, you're just recovering the standard quantum field theory propagator. And so this means that we now, from here to here, have a sort of continuum quantum field theory setting, but with a modified propagator.
How do you interpret this constant? Is it something that doesn't propagate, but it's there, or what does it?
Yeah. So what this effectively tells you, and that will be important for the results, in fact, is that quantum fluctuations don't fall off, or fields don't fall off as quickly in the UV, but instead there is this constant, so fields fall off much slower. And this is also why this sort of makes the theory non-local, right? Because you don't have the usual local fall-off. Instead, you have this constant bit. How to think of that in terms of sort of a good particle picture, I don't have a good answer to that, but I hope that helps. You also had a question?
I'm wondering about this non-locality scale, because it is somewhat introduced ad hoc.
Absolutely.
To avoid a problem. So I'm wondering if then one can attach to it a physical meaning which relates to the original causal set.
Well, so you could say, well, if you really follow this logic here, then in a causal set, you would have to have this scale if you want to have really this expression for the D'Alembertian, because otherwise you would have these big fluctuations. You can also say, well, at this stage here, we sort of give up the original causal set motivation, and we just say we are analyzing a particular non-local quantum field theory, right? But of course, it's a non-local quantum field theory that is strongly motivated by causal sets. And I totally agree that introducing this non-locality scale is somewhat ad hoc to solve this problem. And in fact, what I will be showing you is that I don't think that this is actually a viable solution. And I'll explain to you why.
The constant depends on L.
The constant still depends on the discreteness scale, because if you really take the continuum limit, then you just have the standard propagator.
Because non-locality.
That's a good question. I think it's a numerical constant, but I would have to look it up. Sorry, I can give you the answer later.
Sure.
All right. So what we did with that was to say, oh, okay, if we have a propagator of a scalar field, then that will affect quantum corrections to how the quartic scalar coupling runs in this theory. So if you have this loop diagram here, that contributes to the scale dependence of the quartic coupling. And it's renormalized by quantum fluctuations that run in this loop. And they are now affected, or the UV quantum fluctuations that also contribute to this loop, they now follow this different propagator. And so we then used functional renormalization group techniques, sort of carrying them over from asymptotic safety type studies, to understand what is the consequence of having this regime here where we have the non-local effects. And in particular, a standard quartic field theory has a Landau pole somewhere in the UV where this interaction with the quartic coupling diverges. And we set out to understand whether that would be worse or improved if we have these effects that come from causal set quantum gravity.
So is there a mixing now? Because for causal sets, Lorentzian signature was...
Great question.
Now you're not
the yes.
Signature.
Yes, so it's one of the really big assumptions of our work to say we have this propagator that comes out of a Lorentzian setting. And the only way how we know how to calculate a renormalization group flow with that is to actually, we actually even Wick rotated in a very naive sense. So we didn't really do a full analytical continuation, because this propagator, if you look at it in the complex plane, has a bunch of poles and branch cuts, and it's quite complicated. So we did a more naive Wick rotation, just substituting basically really sort of P0 with minus or with IP0. And we are then using what we call this causal set-inspired propagator. By that, we really mean to say that we are now working in a setting where our propagator is inspired by causal sets, but it's really no longer, in that sense, the causal set propagator that we have translated it to Euclidean. And so that will be one of the big assumptions to interpret the results with. All right. So, but what this allows us to do is to use functional renormalization group techniques to integrate out quantum fluctuations step by step as a function of this scale k here, and get the corresponding scale dependence of the quartic coupling. And so we can integrate out quantum fluctuations in this regime here, where they have this modified propagator, and then in the standard regime. And then we can understand what effect that has on the quartic coupling. And in a standard local quantum field theory, the beta function of that coupling starts off with this positive quadratic term. And if you look at what that actually means for the actual scale dependence of the coupling, because the beta function is positive, that means that the coupling increases as you go to the UV. And if you really integrate that, you can do that analytically, then you're encountering a divergence at a finite scale. That's the Landau pole. First of all, this divergence really just says that perturbation theory that you've applied here breaks down. You can then use non-perturbative techniques to confirm the result. And it's basically the same as you get from the perturbative statement, namely that the theory has a finite range of validity, and it breaks down here at this scale. And so the interpretation is that you need new physics to set in at the scale to extend the theory further into the UV. Now, if you then want to push the scale where the theory breaks down further into the UV, you can do that. But sort of you can see from the sketch, as you push this Landau pole further into the UV, that pulls this curve down. And so the low energy value of that coupling, this lambda naught, that lowers if you want to do that. And that has a consequence for the theory, because if you have a scalar field that undergoes spontaneous symmetry breaking with a vacuum expectation value V, then the mass of that scalar will be proportional to this vacuum expectation value and to this infrared value of that coupling. And so if you demand that the theory holds further into the UV, then you have to lower lambda naught, and that lowers the scalar mass. And for the standard model, this was done quite a while ago by different people who then derived an upper bound on the Higgs mass as a function of the range of validity of the standard model. And so now what we asked is, under the assumption that we can use this Euclideanized propagator so that we are in this causal set inspired case, what happens to this Landau pole? So can these new effects that arise out of causal sets or that are inspired by causal sets, can they solve this problem? So could this sort of non-locality actually be the new physics that you need to solve that problem or not? And what happens is that the Landau pole in the quartic coupling persists, and it basically occurs directly at the non-locality scale. The reason for that basically is that at the non-locality scale, the propagator no longer falls off as 1 over p squared, but it just goes to a constant, which means that in the UV, quantum fluctuations are stronger than they are in the standard quantum field theory sense. And because they are stronger, they just speed up the onset of the Landau pole. And so what you see in this plot here is the upper bound on the scalar mass as a function of the scale up to which your theory holds. The black curve is the one that you would get if you would send the corresponding scale to infinity. So sorry, rho is 1 over the non-locality scale to the 4th power. And now you can see different choices of the non-locality scale. So here, for instance, the pink line is a non-locality scale, which is 1 over 10 to the 9 GeV. And you can see that as soon as you hit 10 to the 9 GeV, this upper bound just plunges towards 0. And that's because quantum fluctuations become so strong that you have to really, really quickly lower the low energy value of that coupling. And even that is not enough. So you basically have to lower the allowed mass or value of the coupling to 0 very, very quickly in order for the theory to still hold. And you basically cannot go beyond the non-locality scale. So what that means is that there must be new physics at this non-locality scale. And the way we interpreted it was to say, well, it's kind of unlikely that the new physics can just be the addition of a few new fields, because presumably, similarly, non-local propagators would also describe other fields. And so therefore, the way we interpreted it is to say that it's really the quantum field theory description that breaks down at the non-locality scale. And that, of course, invalidates one of the initial assumptions to say, well, there's a discreteness scale, and then there's a non-locality scale that is much lower, and we have a quantum field theory in between, but just with a non-locality scale, right? So we see from this that this doesn't appear to work, of course, with the caveats that I mentioned, that we are doing a sort of Euclideanized version of the theory. And we are currently thinking about also whether there are ways to sort of use the newer Lorentzian calculations and asymptotic safety to do something similar here and not have to do this naive weak rotation of the theory. But this is sort of one example where sort of ideas that came out of asymptotic safety, namely thinking of the effect of a quantum gravity theory on matter, where carrying over these ideas to another approach allowed us to learn something that we didn't know before, namely that the separation between non-locality scale and discreteness scale is maybe not something that is viable. And so maybe then a different mechanism to suppress fluctuations is needed. I have no idea what that mechanism would be. All right, so that concludes the asymptotic safety-inspired results in causal sets. And I now sort of flip the two approaches around in the sense that I now think about the key challenge in asymptotic safety and whether I can use causal sets to address it. And this is a challenge that already came up, namely how to test asymptotic safety in Lorentzian signature. Right, so the main technique to test asymptotic safety is the functional renormalization group. And because that needs a cutoff on quantum fluctuations, a cutoff on the sort of generalized forum momentum, it is actually formulated in the Euclidean, so with minus signs here instead of i's, and also with the Euclidean signature in the metric wherever it shows up. And that's simply because in a Lorentzian regime, you can't properly impose a cutoff on the forum momentum that will not actually limit the energies or the three momenta involved. And so basically all, with very few exceptions, results on asymptotic safety are in the Euclidean regime. And so then the idea that I would advocate here is to say we can use causal sets if we don't think of them as fundamentally discrete, but if we just think of the discreteness scale as a regularization of an actual Lorentzian path integral. And so for that, let me talk a little bit about how asymptotic safety would show up in discrete settings and what we are in discretized settings and what we already know in this context about causal sets. And the example that I'll use is causal dynamical triangulations because that's an example where asymptotic safety in a discretized setting has been explored for quite a while. So causal dynamical triangulations, here's your mini lightning review on this third approach, is also based on discrete building blocks. They just look somewhat different than what we use in causal sets. So it's tetrahedra that I used. The key point is that they come with a finite sort of edge length, so they come with a cutoff, with a regularization. And if there is asymptotic safety in the path integral, then this means that you can take the continuum limit where you shrink the size of these edge lengths to zero. And heuristically, the reason why you can take a continuum limit is that if you have a fixed point of the couplings that realizes scale symmetry, and if you're in a regime where the theory is scale symmetric, then it no longer feels how large the size of the building block is. Right? The theory is self-similar, so you can just sort of shrink the edge length to zero. That doesn't change the physics. This is sort of heuristically why scale symmetry allows you to take a continuum limit. More precisely, what one is then typically looking at is a sort of statistical theory in order to be able to do Monte Carlo simulations. And there, scale symmetry in these sort of type lattice type field theories manifests itself as a second order phase transition. And that is because if you have a lattice system and you take it to a second order phase transition, then the correlation length that this lattice system typically has will diverge, and so therefore the theory will become scale symmetric. As a good example, you can think of the Ising model, so just a system of spins sitting on a lattice. At temperatures below the critical temperature, that's just magnetized. At temperatures above the critical temperature, you have islands of either spin up or spin down, and you can see from this plot that these islands sort of have a typical size. Right, so you can see the correlation length in this plot relatively directly. But if you go to the second order phase transition, you can see that these islands of magnetization, they don't have any typical size. Right, so you have very tiny islands all the way to much, much larger islands. And so this here, you cannot put any typical scale to it, or a different way of saying it is that this configuration here is self-similar. Right, and so therefore, as you go to a second order phase transition, you get scale symmetry. And so therefore, if we want to search for asymptotic safety in a lattice-like or discretized setting, what is done is you take the phase diagram of your model that is spanned by the couplings in the model. And these are results from the group of Jan Ambion and Renate Loll and the late Jerzy Jurkiewicz. So these simulations here show the different phases. in the causal set phase diagram, and some of these phase transition lines could actually be of second order and therefore allow you to see asymptotic safety. And now the idea that I would like to advocate here is to say, well, maybe we can use causal sets in a very similar way if we think of them as a discretization or regularization of really Lorentzian geometries. We can then look at the phase diagram of causal sets and try to see whether we find a second order phase transition. And if we do, then we could even compare critical exponents that characterize this phase transition to the functional renormalization group results in the Euclidean setting to see whether there's a big impact of the space-time signature or not. So work along those lines has been done, not with the asymptotic safety motivation in mind, but nevertheless, people have actually run Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations, putting in a curvature term into the action in 1 plus 1 and in 2 plus 1 dimensional causal set settings. And they did find a phase diagram with a phase boundary. They investigated that phase boundary more closely in 1 plus 1 dimensions and found a phase transition that is of first order. So from that, you could first conclude, or one possibility to conclude would be to say that, well, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, at least, there doesn't seem to be asymptotic safety in Lorentzian quantum gravity. Another conclusion would be to say that you haven't actually put in all of the relevant parameters, so your phase diagram is not large enough. That is what I'll be advocating here, because Euclidean FRG studies show that there are three directions that are called relevant directions, and they correspond to directions that you need to tune in order to get to the phase transition. And so if you're just looking at a two-dimensional phase diagram, then you don't have this third parameter, and so therefore you're not likely to actually see the phase transition of second order. So you need one more parameter that you need to tune to get to that phase transition. So just very briefly, what are the Euclidean FRG results that show that these are based on various truncations of the full dynamics that...
In the last transparency, you're talking about scalar field, is that right? Or was it gravity here?
So here I'm talking about gravity.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm glossing over a lot of details here. Yes, so they are in 1 plus 1D and also restricting the configuration space to a particular type of causal sets. Although, I think one thing to emphasize is that if you really want to use causal sets to search for asymptotic safety, you would also restrict the configuration space a lot because you wouldn't care about all causal sets. You would just care about actual discretizations of manifolds. Mm-hmm. So you would only actually take the configuration space of sprinklings. Right? So and therefore, these restrictions here, which make sure that you have causal sets that embed in 1 plus 1 dimension, is actually something that you would even want to do with this asymptotic safety inspiration in mind.
So what did you mean here by saying with curvature term in action? I mean, there should be always a curvature term in action.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I will be advocating, though, that just putting a curvature term will not be enough. You should actually put in higher order curvature terms. Yeah.
And this is the theory in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1, sorry. The theories are topological. Is that an issue? I mean, we hope something?
Yeah. So I'm not sure how that would really play into this setting here necessarily, right? Because it's very unclear whether causal sets in the setting, whether they really just encode Einstein gravity in the sort of standard sense, right? So whether you would not have any additional degrees of freedom effectively represented in this discretized setting.
I think at this level, you don't really see the dynamics.
Yeah, that's maybe another way of saying that.
What does it mean?
But yeah, I mean, ideally, of course, we would want to already have 3 plus 1 dimensional simulations and the corresponding phase diagram. But I'm sort of taking a detour to say that even if that would have been done, I would think that there would be something missing based on the Euclidean results. And so that's what I then sort of want to focus on first. Okay, so based on the Euclidean continuum results, testing various truncations of the action with higher order curvature terms, various of those, there are indications that there are three couplings that are called relevant. And those are the ones that you would need to tune in a discretized setting in order to go to the second order phase transition. And so in particular, they correspond to the Newton coupling and cosmological constant. And then a combination of these two curvature terms, curvature squared terms. And so this is a motivation to think about higher order curvature terms in causal sets. And so that's the actual results that I want to present now. So what we did, together again with Gustavo De Brito and another master student, Christopher Pfeiffer, was to start constructing higher order curvature terms in causal set quantum gravity. And the motivation for that is thinking about causal sets as a way of ultimately accessing asymptotic safety in the Lorentzian regime. Now, if you want to think about higher order curvature terms in causal set quantum gravity, then you immediately encounter the same challenge that you have when you think about any types of fields with indices, that because you don't have a tangent space, you don't know how to construct a Riemann tensor. However, for the action, you don't actually need the Riemann tensor itself. You only need curvature invariants, such as Riemann squared, which are scalar quantities. And then there's reason to suspect that these type of curvature invariants are encoded in causal sets. And the reason to expect that is the Hawking-Malamon theorem that says that under some mild conditions on the space-time, the causal structure is enough to include 9/10 of the metric, so the metric up to a conformal factor. And then this missing one function in the metric in causal sets is recovered simply by counting, because the conformal factor just encodes the information on the volume of the space-time. And in a causal set, you get that by counting how many elements you have in a certain region and associating each element on average with the Planck size space-time volume. And so in this way, causal sets encode all 10 out of 10 functions of the metric. And therefore, we expect that anything that we can build out of the metric and its derivatives, such as curvature invariants, that these should be encoded in causal sets in some way, at least their discrete counterparts. And as a concrete example, I'll show you how to get to this R squared minus 2 box R, which, again, sort of in the spirit of what Abai asked previously about the box minus 1/2 R, we did not pick R squared minus 2 box R for some fundamental reasons, but this was sort of the best that we could do, this particular combination. But I'll give you a speculation about how I think Riemann invariants might be encoded in causal sets. So how do we get to this R squared minus 2 box R? We again get that by going back to this B operator I showed you in the beginning that gives you the box minus 1/2 R. But now I will not focus on the box part that I focused on previously, but I'll focus on the R by taking the scalar field to be constant. And now we sort of did a heuristic argument first and then also went through a more detailed proof. But the heuristic argument basically says that if you take B and act on phi, what you're getting is just some other scalar field, which means that you can act with B again. And if you take the continuum limit of that and the expectation value, then you get box minus 1/2 R of this new scalar field. But this new scalar field was nothing but box minus 1/2 R phi. And then if you take these expressions together and set phi to a constant, this gives you access to R squared minus box R. Now, of course, this is sort of a little bit of sloppy to write, because actually there's expectation values in various places that I sort of just did not put here, and which make it quite non-trivial that that should actually hold. So what we did in the actual paper is we went through a more careful proof of actually showing that indeed the continuum limit of B squared acting on phi reduces to this expression here. But I will not go through the details here, because I don't think it's so illuminating. The remaining thing that I want to briefly show you, and that leads to my speculation about the Riemann invariants, is sort of what do you need in the causal set to build these type of operators. So in order to build the curvature operator, we needed these causal orders, right? So the causally the causally nearest neighbors and next to nearest neighbors. So basically, a nearest neighbor is of x is a point in its past where there is no other point in the volume in between. And then the next to nearest neighbor is a point in the past where there's just one point in between in this volume. And so these causal orders are everything that you need in order to build up R. And then if you look at the construction of R squared, then you sort of take one of these type of causal orders, and then you have to add another one of them on the bottom. And so you get something that we called stacked causal orders, where you sort of get a not the, the full causal interval between the points x and z, but you get the causal interval with this point in between, and you get another causal interval of these two points, and you don't get the contributions from here. So you can think of these sort of stacked causal orders basically as taking sort of causal diamonds and then just sort of building a chain of these causal diamonds all stacked on top of each other. So that's sort of the discrete counterpart of acting consecutively with a bunch of derivative operators on a quantity. And so this leads me to the speculation that if we build a general expression where we sum over causal orders, stacked causal orders of sort of various sort of heights, and we put various coefficients in there and vary those coefficients, then these objects should give us access to curvature operators at that point. Because that's basically the only thing that, given this minimalistic causal structure, you can do which approximates sort of derivative operators. The speculation is, of course, technically somewhat tricky to check. So if you're enthusiastic about it, then feel very welcome to approach me and ask. But so this already brings me to my conclusions. And the remaining thing to say about this here is that this sort of prepares to look at Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations of causal sets with what, from an asymptotic safety point of view, we would believe all of the ingredients in the action that we need to find a second order phase transition. So this would then prepare the grounds to make a sort of stronger test of asymptotic safety in Lorentzian signature, but it's not something that we have done yet, so stay tuned here. But let me also say that also from a causal set point of view, this is actually useful because one of the things that is missing in causal sets is to have many quantities with which to characterize what is the geometry of a causal set. And if you have higher order curvature operators or their discrete counterparts, then you can say something more about whether the causal set you're looking at is manifold-like or not. All right, and so that actually brings me to my summary just in time. So the overarching message that I try to convey is to say that there is physics to be discovered in the space between quantum gravity approaches. And what I mean by that is to say that there are some challenges in individual approaches that can be met by importing tools or results or ideas from other approaches. I don't mean to say that you can meet all challenges in this way. I just think you can actually meet some of them. And I think therefore it's worthwhile to think about these type of connections between quantum gravity approaches. And to support this sort of general hope or dream, I gave you two concrete examples. Within asymptotic safety and causal set quantum gravity, I showed you that by using this sort of meta-matters approach and FRG techniques from asymptotic safety, you can actually find a Landau pole in the scalar quarter coupling in causal sets. And that led us to conclude that you may not, that it might not be possible to actually choose this non-locality scale far below the discreteness scale. And that would actually also kill some associated causal set phenomenology. And then the second example is to work that sort of sets out to ultimately use causal sets as a Lorentzian regularization of the gravitational path integral and test asymptotic safety. And as a first step to do that, we constructed some of the necessary higher order terms in the causal set. And so with that, let me thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to the questions and discussion.
Thank you very much, Marietta. First student, question by student.
Yeah. I think I didn't quite understand your motivation of constructing these higher order terms. So mm-hmm. You don't know the curvature tensor itself, so somehow you mm-hmm. require a second operator. And also, is there a systematic way in which you neglect some higher order terms that which you can't construct in this way?
Mm-hmm. So the motivation to construct this is because what enters in the action is curvature invariance, right? So it's not something like the Riemann tensor with uncontracted indices. It's always something where you have an actual curvature invariant. The motivation from asymptotic safety is that we think a combination of these two higher order curvature terms is one of the parameters that you need to tune to get to the phase transition, right? And so then this object is sort of what we can so far access in the causal set.
There's also the Einstein-Hilbert term.
So
I mean, they know how to do this.
I mean, the Einstein Hilbert term, right? You basically get that from here, right? So from this operator, when you take phi to a constant, that is what gives you the Einstein Hilbert term, right? And now doing the same thing, adds this particular combination of higher order curvature terms. And then I think you ask whether there are also some higher order terms that are neglected. Did you mean in this construction here?
I think the question is whether all of these invariants that you showed you can construct in this way and probe.
Oh. So what we understand is how to sort of generalize this and construct higher orders of this, right? So basically combinations of R with box R. What we don't understand how to construct is more complicated invariants like Riemann invariants. This is where I had this speculation here in the end that I think what will play a role is the sort of stacking of causal orders, because that is sort of a way to generalize what you do when you're looking at derivatives from a point. And that's because the causal set is so minimalistic, that is basically the only thing that you can do in this way. And so based on the Hawking-Malamon theorem, I expect that all curvature invariants must be recoverable from a causal set. And this is the speculation that this would be the way how to do that. But yeah, currently I can't tell you whether it's true or not.
Ding has a question online. Go for it.
Yes, thank you. This question is related to the one just asked. Could you go to the summary slide?
Yeah.
Yes. For the last set of points, causal sets of the Lorentz regularity. And there you made the point that the second point, first step, construct necessary higher order terms in the causal set action.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, this is not in the context of the causal set program itself. It's in the context of your program using causal set.
Yeah. So necessary in the sense of I believe that those are necessary if you want to see a second order phase transition. Does that answer the question?
No, could one also ask the question in the context of causal set program itself? I consider a fundamental causal set. There's fundamental discreteness.
Mm-hmm.
Then in this case, do you also think that's necessary to include higher order terms?
I would say it's unclear. That depends on whether you can show that using just the what is known as the Benning-Casa-Dauker action, so basically the discrete version of the Einstein-Hilbert action, if that is really enough to give you destructive interference between all manifold-like causal sets, so that you really have as the expectation value emerging from the causal set something that is a sprinkling into De Sitter spacetime with a small cosmological constant. If you can show that, then they would not be necessary in pure causal sets. But we don't know that. Yeah.
I see. So this statement you make, it's you only know it to be meaningful in your program, but not in the causal set program.
Yeah, I mean it's all in this, you know, connection between asymptotic safety and causal sets, right? So in causal sets, I don't know what I need to include in the action in order to get a predictive path integral with destructive interference with all of the non-manifold-like causal sets. That's an unanswered question in general.
That's good, thank you.
Preliminary results that relate to second order phase transition.
You have preliminary results?
No, that's what you said. Preliminary results on the simulations did not lead to a second order phase transition.
No, you mean in these examples that I...
By Sumati and William and Lisa.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, in the 1+1 dimensional case, I believe they looked at that in more detail. Yeah.
But maybe, I mean, it's
but you don't need a second order phase transition in like a pure causal set setting, right?
Yeah,
with the
yeah.
fundamental discreteness scale, you don't really care about the order of the phase transition.
But, I mean, it's excellent to look at Lorentzian signature, but then you said your plan would be to do also Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
Which is a naive Euclidean rotation, which they also do there, which
yes.
It's a bit skeptical.
Yeah, so this is sort of, I would say, following this program, this is really sort of the one point where it's not nice in the sense that you're really not staying with Lorentzian signature. You're introducing some arbitrary parameter in front of the action, and then you hope that you can analytically continue in that parameter.
And I don't know this. I guess you know that, but there's some recent work by Somaki and Steve Kaleb about the cancellation of ugly things.
Yes.
And I think this cancellation depends on really doing a Lorentzian, on having an eye in the past.
Yeah. Yes. So I think there's also some previous work by Steve where you can really show that if you really take the quantum mechanical phase factor, you can really get destructive interference in the path integral, right? And of course, in the Euclidean, the only thing you can ever get is suppression of a particular configuration, but you know that you have interference between configurations, this is something specifically Lorentzian.
Yeah.
And and indeed.
See that in the Lorentzian.
Yes. Yeah, but I think for this question of the phase transition, it would be sort of a different type of question.
Uh-huh.
Right. But yeah, I mean, having a nice tool that really gives access to the full path integral without having to do a new parameter that you then analytically continue, that would be nice, of course. Yeah.
I'm back.
Yeah, so I also have a question on this kind of using causal sets to approach the second order phase transition. So if you want to approach the second order phase transition, you would eventually want to decrease your lattice spacing, I guess. And at some point conflict with your definition of a curvature invariance that require this discreteness on non-locality scale to be finite.
That's to suppress the fluctuations.
Yeah.
Right? So you would then say, well, I accept that for a single configuration you have large fluctuations away from the expectation value. Right, because the only thing that I really need is sort of that the thing that comes out of the full path integral, so the expectation value, that is somehow well behaved, and I accept that the fluctuations about that might grow. That might mean that the simulations could become quite tricky.
A point to make your point about the three coupling constant stronger is that the same is observed in CDT and in EDT.
Well, I mean, I think the CDT people would say that they just need two parameters to get a second order phase transition, right? But then, of course, if they try to construct renormalization group trajectories, somehow they don't seem to approach the second order phase transition.
Yeah, but in the discrete, I count three, but maybe if you rescale, you have only two, you say?
So, I mean,
it's the anisotropy, count as an addition to lambda and G.
Well, I mean, usually they fix the volume so they don't have the cosmological constant, right? And so therefore they have two parameters, but yeah.
I count But then an EDT is three.
Yeah, I think EDT would agree that you need three. Yeah.
Treatment of a volume is similar, but I mean, it is auto-tuned, right? I mean, you tune the cosmological constant such that the volume remains fixed. So I wouldn't say.
That's right. So in that sense, maybe you could say it's three. But yeah, you could read EDT as another confirmation that you need a curvature squared term.
Okay, then. But then I thought CDT then should also count as three.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
So but I mean, I think the CDT people don't say they tune, but yeah, maybe.
So how would the partner moves look like in these causal sets? So what, like in CDT, you have your partner moves, so what would be the like analog to that? And is it clear or proven that this like satisfy ergodicity or these kind of things?
Okay, so. For these cases that Tsumati and collaborators looked at, they restricted to very particular causal sets so that they could indeed sort of probe the configuration space ergodically. What one would want to do for this sort of asymptotic safety in a Lorentzian program is to just sample overall sprinklings into manifolds. And it is not known how you get from one sprinkling to another. So in practice, you would probably have to do something where you sort of give yourself a selection of continuum manifolds that you say are included, and you somehow limit topology, and maybe you also impose an upper bound on the curvature and things like that. And then you sprinkle into each of those, and this then generates your configuration space. So the analog of Pachner moves is not known. I mean, it would be awesome to know that. Yeah. So, in other words, to really complete this program of using causal sets to probe asymptotic safety, there's quite a few non-trivial steps that we still need to take. We took step sort of 0.1.
Okay, I think on that we can thank Astrid for her talk. Thank you very much.